Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
This is the CNS Evening News with Ted Troutman.
Good evening. We begin tonight with an update on the revolution sweeping across the Middle East. Widespread protests have already destabilized governments in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. And as Brian Gibble reports, Iran could be the next totalitarian state to fall.
Protests have erupted in Iran in the wake of popular uprisings that toppled authoritarian governments in Egypt and Tunisia. Hundreds of thousands have turned out across the country to demand an end to Islamist rule. The government has responded violently, beating, killing, and arresting opposition leaders. A large number of Iranians are taking refuge in Turkey. And in Berkeley, Iranian emigres like Parvez Shokat are working to support the rebellion.
We've been trying to help the refugees in Turkey and trying to organize whatever we can, connecting people in terms of an opposition outside the country.
He recently spoke with an Iranian political activist living in Turkey who described the continuing crackdowns. Abbas Milani, director of Iranian studies at Stanford, predicts change will come, but slowly.
What we are going to witness in Iran is certainly a change to a more democratic polity. Whether it will take the form of a violent revolution or not, I really don't see it.
But Shokat says protesters need help to succeed.
In Iran, people have done a lot, they have sacrificed a lot, and now it's time for the Iranian outside the country to, you know, pick up the banner and be more active.
This is Brian Gibble reporting for CNS News.
Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi was released from house arrest last November. Now the Nobel laureate is reaching out to supporters across the world, including students here in Berkeley. Here's Mark Altman's.
In the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, repressive generals have ruled with an iron fist for nearly half a century. The government often hands out severe punishments for seemingly simple offenses.
If you emigrate without government approval, that single emigrate can land you 15 years imprisonment.
Last November, the military junta tried to show the world that it's softening its grip. It held elections for the first time in 20 years, and released from house arrest the pro-democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi, who her compatriots simply call the lady.
First things we can start doing is to resist injustice.
My dad always told me a story of the year I was born. It was when the big protests were happening, and she was there leading the movement, and he told me how many times, you know, he risked his life just to see her speak.
UC Berkeley student Michael Gaw runs an informal class on Burmese history. Since Suu Kyi's release, he's been on a mission to get a hold of her.
So we kind of just had a crazy thought to ourselves. He says, hey, you know, what if we can get her to speak at our class?
To his surprise, they got through to Suu Kyi, and she accepted his invitation.
Now joining us live on the telephone, please help me welcome Aung San Suu Kyi. Aung San Suu Kyi, are you there?
Yes, thank you very much. It's a very warm welcome.
The audience joined a 40-minute question-answer session with the 65-year-old Nobel Prize winner. For one student, the exchange was especially poignant.
I remember meeting with you, with my mother, in your home in Yangon in 1996 when I was 6 years old. And now I'm a student at Berkeley getting the chance to speak to you 15 years later.
I would like to remember that there's a need in Burma for educated people, for help from qualified people.
My father was a political prisoner, so it was just me, my brother, and my mom. I feel like today I had a voice, like I could actually speak to the lady that's giving everybody else hope.
But in the end, we shall prevail. We shall be able to bring about the changes that we want in Burma.
This is Mark Altman's reporting for CNS News.
And now, we bring you to ongoing unrest here in California, where students, teachers, and labor activists protest drastic cuts to public education. Patricia Espinosa reports.
March 2nd marked a day of action for California public schools. Demonstrators rallied at UC Berkeley's Sproul Plaza to protest Governor Jerry Brown's budget cuts of higher education.
I'm here today because of my passion for art.
Mason Gutierrez, a junior high student, fears the cuts will hurt the quality of his future college education.
Jerry Brown's proposed $1.4 billion budget cuts are taking away the things we love in school.
In an effort to recover from a $25 billion state deficit, Brown proposed a $500 million cut to the University of California system and $900 million more from California State University and community college systems.
The biggest dilemma he's in is he's got a $25 billion budget deficit and he has to somehow find a way to cover that. And one way he's found is to propose that we extend taxes, but that's not going to cover the whole budget deficit. So he actually has to cut programs. There's just no question about it.
Next year, UC Berkeley will increase its tuition by 8%, leaving Gutierrez with fewer hopes of attending college.
They don't think of the fact that you'd have to be rich to go to college if these cuts go through, which you would either have a scholarship, and with my grades, that's seriously a joke, let me tell you.
Hours later, demonstrators attempted to occupy Wheeler Hall by staging a sit-in. The next day, protesters who sat on the fourth-floor ledge of the building came to an agreement with police to leave Wheeler Hall without being arrested.
Education must be free. Public education is a right, not a privilege, and we're in it to win it. We're not going anywhere.
I think that there's probably no chance that there'll be any change in the cuts to higher education. I think that there's just not any room for that to happen. I don't think there's any will in the legislature to do it.
Brown's revised state budget will be available in mid-May, and any cuts in education enacted this summer. This is Patty Espinosa reporting for CNS News.
And now, CNS correspondent Rosa Ramirez brings us the story of one man who beat the odds, working all day and facing abuse from employers for pay that never comes. That was the life of Jose Cruz, a day laborer here in California. In a San Francisco court, Cruz fought for the wages he was owed and won.
Jose Cruz is a day laborer who, like many others, did the work but sometimes didn't get paid.
Cuando me dio un cheque, no tiene fondo.
When the check bounced, Cruz sought legal help from a San Francisco activist group. Attorney Renee Salcedo says the office regularly handles similar cases.
Employers think that they can get away with it. They perceive this pool of workers as being vulnerable because of the way they look for work, because of their immigration status.
Day laborers across the country face a range of abuses such as no time for a lunch or a bathroom break. But wage theft robs them of the sole reason they work.
Me dijeron que me iban a pagar y finalmente desconectaron el teléfono. O sea, eso ocurre muy a menudo.
Oscar Rodriguez is a Guatemalan immigrant who lost his restaurant job 2 months ago. He now looks for work every morning in San Rafael, where he and 40 other immigrants compete for limited jobs.
O sea, ahorita alguien si tiene suerte tal vez trabaja un día.
The California Labor Commission says last year the agency accepted 37,000 claims of wage theft. Contractors or homeowners hire day laborers to work in landscaping, painting, and other construction jobs. Delphine Vigil of the Marin Opportunity Center says they often do dangerous work.
Moving, hauling, digging fence posts, removal of asbestos, lead paint removal, stuff that people find in their homes and they don't want to deal with it.
Many undocumented workers don't come forward because they fear they will be deported. And employers often threaten them, saying things like,
"We're not going to pay you. If you keep calling me and asking for money, I'm going to call immigration."
But the Labor Commission says a worker's immigration status does not matter. And despite the intimidation, some day laborers are determined to collect their money.
Si lo voy a dejar, lo va a hacer otra vez con otra persona.
Lawyers took Jose Cruz's case to the California Labor Commission and won a settlement of more than $6,000. Advocates say there's a need to educate workers about their rights so they can get the benefits they deserve. This is Rosa Ramirez reporting for CNS News.
The book business is in peril as book giant Borders announced in February that it will close 200 stores across the country. But here in Berkeley, Christina Lopez finds one bookstore thriving.
With Borders in bankruptcy and Barnes & Noble selling its superstores, what's the future like for smaller bookstores?
I don't really see what the role of community-based, local, physical bookstores is going to be.
Andy Ross ran Cody's Books for 30 years in Berkeley, until competition from Amazon, the big chain bookstores, and ebooks forced him to sell the literary landmark in 2006.
Ebooks are a small part of the business, but they're growing exponentially.
As the spread of ebooks continues to grow, smaller bookstores in Berkeley are surviving. And one of them is not only thriving, but also expanding. Amazon and eBooks don't intimidate co-owners Ann Leahy and Marion Abbott.
We prefer the printed book. That's really what we're about, and we're not going to stop doing that or jump up and down about eBooks. It's not our favorite method.
Local independent bookseller Mrs. Dalloway's here in Berkeley says they offer something their online retailers can't: customer service.
We know our customers. Our customers are people who live in the neighborhood. We know their families. We know their dogs. It's a place where we have conversations about books.
Borders bookstores each carry about 20,000 book titles. That's almost twice as many as Mrs. Dalloway's. But big isn't what customers like Michelle Geary seem to be looking for. She drove 50 miles just to visit Mrs. Dalloway's.
For me, it's, you know, this is it. You know, this is where I want to go because I know that they're going to have things that I can't find anywhere else.
The smaller stores are not on the radar of these big chain stores. They have very low overhead, so they don't have to do the kind of sales volume that stores like Cody's had to do or that superstores have to do to be successful.
Despite the popularity of online retailers and ebooks, Mrs. Dalloway's has one final piece of advice for their customers.
Buy more books. Come on down.
This is Christina Lopez reporting for CNS News.
The times, they are a-changing, and not just for the book business. The recording industry has gone into a free fall as more and more young listeners turn to the internet for their music. But in the new millennium, one company has emerged as an industry leader, the online radio service known as Pandora. Here's Hunter Holcomb with the report.
Like most musicians, Danielle Anderson tours constantly to build her fan base, one person at a time. Recently, she was thrilled to discover her music was on Pandora, the popular internet radio site.
So I felt a little bit like a child on Christmas morning, and I ran around the house and then listened to it all day, and every time one of my songs came on, I felt famous.
In February, Pandora announced its IPO, the initial sale of stock to the public. An important milestone for any company, this action will solidify Pandora's position in the surging industry as music continues to migrate to online platforms. Pandora, based here in downtown Oakland, declined to comment while the details of the IPO are being finalized. Yet this announcement is clear validation for a company that has teetered on bankruptcy since its launch in 2000. John Duman, a music industry attorney, says the company's success is largely due to their perseverance and passion.
Pandora sort of come out, and they are the grassroots type, the hippies, I think, perhaps, is the best way to say it. There were, you know, years in which, you know, everybody kind of like laughed them off, and they really didn't have any type of investment support, and it was just sheerly for the love of it that these people were doing it.
Financial complications nearly crushed Pandora in 2008, but today they boast more than 80 million users. And while their future is still uncertain, the company's survival is nothing but good news for musicians like Anderson.
The gift they give me is just, you know, pinpointing me and targeting me and saying, hey, listen to this. And that's cool, just to get my name out there in another way.
This is Hunter Holcomb reporting for CNS News.
Reporter Emily Bender takes us inside the walls of San Quentin, one of the nation's most notorious prisons. What she finds, you might not expect.
This, to me, is a release that helps me get away from the outside environment. It's therapy.
They're called paper whites.
The mission of the Insight Garden program is to help to rehabilitate men through connection to nature, to really use nature as transformation.
Volunteer Beth Wakis says her weekly gardening class gives these men new life skills and raises their self-esteem.
It really creates a sense of pride and nourishment for the soul. It sort of nurture plants, nurture self.
We all came from the dirt, you know, so it just feels like I'm home, I'm relaxed. You know, you can take your mind somewhere else.
Along with caring for plants, Beth encourages what she calls the inner gardener.
As you breathe in, why don't you bring up that energy through your body?
She guides meditation to help deal with the stress of medium security housing, where 200 men share one large dorm room. Jeff Rutland is a former inmate.
I can describe the physical layout to prison. I can't describe the noise
the lack of privacy, this retribution, just not meant for me to be comfortable.
I can't see how to block out all that's going on around you completely, though.
Okay, so the noise around you in the dorms can be hard. It can be hard to meditate. But again, if you practice that, it's a good thing.
But the garden offers a neutral place in a sometimes tense environment.
Prison's a very segregated place. Whites, blacks, Hispanics, we don't mix. But it's a trip because in the class, we're friends. But when we leave the class and walk to the dorm, there's a barrier, a line that goes up, an understanding that certain things we just can't do.
These men will be among the 120,000 parolees leaving California prisons this year. Hopefully, with what they've learned, they won't be among the 70% who will return to San Quentin. This is Emily Bender reporting for CNS News.
We take you now to a controversy brewing in America's farmlands. Carl Nassman talks to farmers who are worried about a genetically engineered crop.
It's lunchtime at the Strauss Family Dairy in Sonoma County, and the cows are chowing down on alfalfa, the main ingredient in dairy feed. But last month, federal officials approved a new genetically modified, or GMO, alfalfa, and that has organic dairy farmers like Albert Strauss worried.
Alfalfa is one of our main feeds that we feed our cows. It's essential to our operation, and if it's contaminated, we won't have that as a resource anymore, and it will be devastating for us.
Alfalfa is the latest GMO crop from the biotech company Monsanto. It's engineered to work with another Monsanto product, a weed killer called Roundup. But certified organic dairies must use non-GMO feed, and if Monsanto's alfalfa mixes with regular feed, it could put organic dairies out of business.
It gets pollinated by bees, and bees fly up to 5 miles. Contamination could happen pretty rapidly, and it would probably price us out of the market for people.
But UC Davis professor Daniel Putnam is less worried about GMO contamination. He says if grown properly, the two varieties can coexist.
There hasn't been a recorded instance that I know of gene transfer to another hay crop. It's something that I think can relatively easily be handled.
Some alfalfa farmers can't wait to plant the new crop.
I guess I'm addicted to chemicals, but it's
Dwayne Chamberlain grows alfalfa in Yolo County. He says Monsanto's Roundup Ready alfalfa will help him battle weeds that are poisonous to cows.
Using Roundup on alfalfa is so much milder on the environment than the products that we're using now to kill weeds, and we have to have clean fields. I can't sell crops that are full of weeds.
But organic advocates are standing firm. They say any amount of GMO contamination could lead to disaster.
Alfalfa is pollinated by bees. Bees don't read signs. You know, they cross-pollinate at distances of many miles. Feed has to be 100% organic. That's the bottom line.
GMO alfalfa is legal for now, but the Center for Food Safety plans to file a lawsuit against Monsanto later this month. This is Carl Nassman reporting for CNS News.
This next story looks at a very different threat to the food system, coyotes. U.S. government agents kill over 90,000 coyotes each year to protect livestock. But Becca Friedman tells us the story of one group that's trying a different approach.
This time of year now, everything's starting to really go. The green grass is coming. They all just got their heads down and everybody's happy.
Rancher Bill Jensen is one of many sheep farmers in Marin County who have seen their herds depleted by predatory animals like coyotes.
You know, you have to live this life in order to really understand, you know, the frustration that sometimes we end up with when we have our animals killed.
The federal government spends more than $100 million a year to protect livestock. But research shows the money is often not well spent. Camilla Fox, executive director of Project Coyote, agrees.
We exploit their populations through trapping, poisoning, aerial gunning. This can ultimately be counterproductive, and their populations, as shown in science, will quickly rebound.
That's because when coyotes are killed, the rest of their pack compensates by breeding even more.
The responsibility lies on the ranchers to better protect their livestock.
So Fox works with ranchers and county officials to promote more humane ways of saving livestock, like funding fences and animals to guard them.
So instead of killing wildlife, the program actually helps ranchers implement long-term predator control deterrence.
I can hear it pulsating right now. You hear that?
Jensen installed an electric fence and says it's protecting his sheep, but also the coyotes, who play an important role in many ecosystems.
If you remove coyotes from a population, foxes, raccoons, opossums, their populations in turn can increase, and they can then have a devastating impact on the ground and songbird populations.
County officials say that livestock loss is down, and the county is saving money since the program began 6 years ago. Jensen says it's not the perfect solution.
This isn't the end-all to end-all. It's a tool. It's one more tool that we're using and that helps.
This is Becca Friedman reporting for CNS News.
For decades, San Francisco has gone to great lengths maintaining its coastline at Ocean Beach. But rising sea levels and recent erosion is forcing the community to change their plans. Malika Menon filed this report.
Ocean Beach is the widest and longest expanse of sand on San Francisco's shoreline. It stretches over 3.5 miles. This is where the city meets the Pacific Ocean. The beach is an important piece of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, but it's not exactly wilderness. The Great Highway and a major city sewer line run right alongside. Bob Battaglio, an engineer and a surfer, is someone who is well aware of this coastal clash.
If you look up here, we have a whole city full of roads, and we don't have much beach left.
Last winter's storm surges led to massive erosion of a chunk of the parking lot south of Sloat Boulevard. The city responded by dumping rubble to shore up the road.
Why do we need a parking lot on the beach? I'm not happy about the amount of money we're spending on something that seems to be almost literally throwing money off the into the ocean.
To find long-term solutions, the city hired a San Francisco-based think tank, SPUR, to create a master plan for Ocean Beach.
We're here as a kind of an outside convener, because there's no one entity that is sort of charged with looking at Ocean Beach as a whole place.
Funded by city agencies, the project kicked off in January. The idea is to get the community involved in discussing the issues facing Ocean Beach.
There's way too many dogs, and that needs to be controlled.
The master plan also focuses on basic amenities like restrooms on the beach and on daunting issues like rising sea levels. The next community meeting is scheduled for May. The plan should be finalized by year end and sent to the city, state, and federal officials who will decide the future of Ocean Beach. This is Malika Menon reporting for CNS News.
San Francisco beachfront may be disappearing, but there's still one coastal property that no one seems to want. Julia Chan takes us to the only privately owned island in the San Francisco Bay, which just happens to be for sale.
If you've ever wanted to own a private island, look no further than off the Richmond shoreline. Red Rock Island is the only private island in the San Francisco Bay, and it's up for sale. But if you were expecting a tropical paradise, think again. No smooth white sand here, just a little under 6 acres of jagged gravel and steep terrain. No palm trees either, but plenty of poison oak. All this with the mineral rights for only $22 million.
Everybody's first question is, what can I do with it?
Realtor Stephen Higby says the island is worth the price because the rock inside is very valuable. Nevertheless, he hasn't seen much serious interest in Red Rock since he put it on the market 4 years ago.
I've never shown the island, like hop in a boat and run out, and, you know, there's certainly no lockbox on the island like you'd have on a front door of a home that's for sale.
This unique property also comes with a unique problem. The borders of three counties converge on Red Rock, which makes developing it a potentially uphill battle.
I think it's impossible. I can't imagine anybody ever getting anything done there.
Richmond City Council member Tom Butt would know. He runs the nonprofit that restored nearby East Brother Island.
Try buying fire insurance from a place where a fire truck can't get to. Everything has to come and go by boat, and try maintaining a boat. It's hugely expensive.
Nobody is saying you can't do this and you can't do that.
I can't imagine why anybody would want to try it.
It's just somebody needs to decide what they want to do.
So until the next owner makes the $90,000 monthly payments, it looks like the birds and seals will have Red Rock all to themselves. On Red Rock Island, this is Julia Chan reporting for CNS News.
And Finally, tonight, we bring you the story of a political and cultural battle in the Bay Area. A California bill introduced last month will ban the trade of shark fins, used for the Chinese delicacy, shark fin soup. Major Tian brings us the story of an endangered species.
One of the sea's most notorious predators, sharks now find themselves endangered. Their numbers have declined by more than 80%, and roughly one-fourth of shark species are now on the verge of extinction.
If we continue at the current rate, we're going to lose all our sharks by 2050. 99% of the species are gone.
David McGuire has years of experience studying sharks. He says illegal fishing practices are threatening the sharks.
It's believed that shark finning is the major threat to shark populations worldwide. In illegal finning, the sharks are finned, the bodies are thrown overboard.
More than 73 million sharks die each year to meet the growing demand for shark fin soup, which can fetch up to $100 a bow. Now environmentalists and California politicians like Paul Fong want to ban the import and sale of shark fins.
When the top predator goes, it's like a house of cards. The ocean can fall.
But many in the Chinese community oppose the ban, particularly restaurant owners and importers.
So this is really a biased law against the Asian community. Shark fin soup has been really a long history and heritage of the Asian people. And we usually only consume that during our wedding or banquets. It's something prestigious.
Well, you know, in the Chinese culture, we used to bind women's feet, too. It's unhealthy for the sharks to get their fins removed and thrown back into the water.
But many are left wondering why the ban would single out cultural staple like shark fin soup, but nothing else.
The sauces.
If it is legal to consume in other proper shark, why shark fin? Anyway, you had to kill the shark. So that's why we believe this bill is picking on the Asian community.
The bill is now being reviewed by attorneys and may see a vote by an assembly committee within the next month. This is Major Tan reporting for CNS News.
And that's the news. I'm Ted Troutman. Like the fish. Good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.